Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Okay, folks, welcome to the latest edition, the latest chapter, the latest rollicking adventure from Life on Planet Porky with myself, the Porkmeister, and, of course, the rock chick writer extraordinaire, Ms. Leslie Ann Jones. Ms. Jones, how are we this fine day?
Steaming, yeah, Michael. Yeah. Absolutely steaming. Yeah. It's been yesterday. I mean, I've always had, this is going to sound weird, I've always had a sweaty face.
Oh, right, okay.
And I've gone to such lengths as ordering very expensive facial gel from Australia,
wow,
which I did a couple of years ago, which cost me a bloody fortune,
yeah,
to slap this all on before you put anything else on your face. You know, mm-hmm. This is guaranteed, like an underarm deodorant,
yeah,
to stop you sweating.
Yes.
It bloody doesn't, I tell you. Yeah. Nothing works. I think it's one of your body's cooling mechanisms. Obviously, that's what sweating is about.
Yeah.
But your face, I mean, literally yesterday, the sweat was running down my face like a shower.
Yeah, dear.
And my face was bright red. Mm. So my body was obviously overheating.
Yes. I have the same sort of problem. I've always had the problem with heat. Now, I've done television three or four times in the last week or so. And then when you come out of a television studio and you've got makeup all over your face, I mean, powder and foundation cream and all that kind of stuff, and you walk into the heat, the minute you start perspiring, it runs off your face and drips onto your shirt. It's awful, you know.
So do you not have it all taken off before you leave the studio?
Sometimes there isn't time if I've got somewhere else to go, you know, or the makeup lady's doing somebody else and I'd have to wait 10 minutes or something like that, you know what I mean? So I usually grab a couple of, you know, those wet wipe things and try my bit off, but there's so much of it, you never get it all off. And I agree, it's terribly messy, but, you know, they are. But, no, I'm just so fed up with the weather. I was told anyway, I kept a really close eye on the weather report. It was all going to be over by 6 p.m. last Saturday. So I thought, great, can have a normal Saturday night, a normal Sunday, a normal Monday. And I was working again in town yesterday, and it was a nightmare trying to get across London. I mean, after the show, the TV station's very good. They give you a car to take where you want. But I only wanted taking across town to another meeting I had. But then I had to get back across town after that meeting, you know, via the tube and everything. And it's just a nightmare in this weather. I hate it with a passion. So I have decided now, I've made an absolute decision that next year I'm going to take the whole of the month of August off, and I'm going to go either to the Shetland Isles, or where it's always around about 17 or 18 when it's about 32 or 33 here, or I'm going to go to Estonia, which has a mean average temperature in the summer of 22. And I've been looking up Estonia, reading good things about it, and Tallinn, which is its capital, is a, you know, a really bustling sort of go-ahead Eastern European city. So that's where I will be this time next year, Miss Jones.
Well, I might even come and visit you. But
yeah,
I think Estonia, Tallinn especially, would suit you much better than the Shetlands.
Yes, why?
What are you going to do for the whole of August? I mean, there's nothing there. It's a very remote place.
Well,
it's got a very sort of local community feel to it. Nothing wrong with that.
Yes, I think you mean.
If you like that sort of thing, but you'd be bored within a week.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I mean, maybe you know, there's lots of water around there. You could go on all sorts of sea trips to all the other islands, you know what I mean?
Trust me, we used to go to Applecross every August.
Oh, yeah.
Which
where's
is
that?
You know, it's if you get to Inverness, you're about halfway there. Mm-hmm. It's very extremely north, the Applecross Peninsula in the sort of Western Highlands. Mm-hmm. We used to go up there and take this manse, which is like a vicarage, really, with my ex-husband's cousins and all the children.
Right.
Very remote beaches, nothing there at all. You couldn't possibly buy something like an ice cream on these beaches. You know, they're very unspoiled. Mm. And because there were a lot of us, we made our own fun.
Yeah.
We all cooked together. We went on long walks. We went
played cricket
pub.
On the beach.
You know, all of those things. And kids can be occupied for hours on end with a bucket and spade.
And running around on the rocks and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. So, and we went across to the Isle of Skye and things like that. I have to tell you, standing on the beach looking at the Isle of Skye is infinitely preferable to being on the Isle of Skye. Mm. It's not a very interesting place.
Really?
No.
Right.
It's one of the most romanticised destinations on earth, isn't it, really?
But over the sea to sky,
exactly. Yeah. Speed bonny boat. But yeah, it's not a very interesting place. But I was looking up other places that you could go, Michael.
Mm-hmm.
So Finland, for example, is a good destination.
Yeah, Finland's good, but very expensive.
Outer Mongolia would do.
Outer Mongolia, not really my scene, to be honest. Don't fancy living in a yurt and riding around on a yak.
What about Iceland? We like Reykjavik.
Oh, I love Iceland. I love it a bit. I've been there a number of times. I think it's brilliant. I went there before it became a popular tourist location, and it's got really commercialised now, and it's packed now with people in 4x4s driving around all over the place. But
yeah, it's a rich country. But
yeah.
Oh, I tell you what I did find out, and this surprised me.
Yeah.
The country with the most consistent temperature on Earth.
Yeah.
Steady in the mid-70s, so very comfortable all the year round.
Right.
Very unchangeable. Where do you think that
South is? Africa?
Nuh-uh. Ecuador.
Ecuador, right, okay. Yeah, South America.
And, it's right on the equator, so
yes.
It's stable.
Yes.
Hawaii also comes top of the list as well.
Yeah, I'll tell you one place I notice is always 28 degrees on all the weather maps. You know when you're watching Sky News and they have that globe that's, goes around all the time with all the different temperatures around the world? Barbados is always 28, always. It never varies, winter or summer. And that's why people love it so much, because the weather there is so predictable.
My friend Ed Bicknell, he was the manager of Dire Straits for about 26 years.
Yeah.
He had a house on the beach in Barbados
and
sold it in the end.
Wow.
And I said, why? You know, why would you sell your house in paradise?
Yeah.
And he said, paradise gets very boring after a while.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably true for people like us who are used to buzzing around in the capital, plenty of people to see, stuff to do.
Yeah.
You know, we're busy people. We don't do holidays very easily, do
no,
we?
No, I totally agree. So why do you think Estonia would suit me better than the Shetlands then? Surely Tallinn would become just as humdrum as the Shetlands after a while, wouldn't it?
No, because Tallinn is a capital city, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
It's the location as well. You're between Finland and the Baltic Sea up there.
That's right. And you've also got
quite a lot of interesting stuff going on, isn't
and
there?
Lithuania next to you. I've been to both of those as well, football-wise, and they're both great countries. But anyway, there we go. My initial interest in Estonia was prompted by the fact that at one of my local pubs, before lockdown and COVID and all that, there was the most beautiful barmaid. I mean, utterly...
Oh, here we go.
She was utterly beautiful, honestly. And
it always boils down to sex.
Well, I'm not sure it does, but her name was Lizzie, and she had dark black hair. She had the most magnificent figure. I mean, I'm not joking. You know, she was beautiful.
Not that you checked her out or anything.
Well, you couldn't help but check her out, because the way she dressed was, I mean, talk about the definition of the buxom wench, you know, serving behind the bar for...
Oh, you are so predictable.
For want of using an old-fashioned expression, which, of course, I wouldn't use these days. But, I mean, it was, you know, men used to go to that pub just to be able to stand on the other side of the bar and ogle Lizzie, because she was so beautiful. And
to ogle Lizzie's assets.
Yes, that's right.
Oh, dear,
Of course, I wasn't amongst that number. I'm mature enough and able enough to look a woman in the eye, you know what I mean, without...
Without noticing what's going on below.
That's right, without becoming distracted. distracted. And, and then one day I was in there on a Sunday and she wasn't paying attention to me. And I said, oh, I'm very sorry. And she was watching the Grand Prix motoring. And for the first time ever, there was a driver from Estonia in it. And so I didn't know where she'd come from before that. I just guessed it was somewhere like, you know, Ukraine or Russia or something. And she said, no, I'm from Estonia. And sadly, lockdown and all that, she went back to Estonia and we've never seen her again. So I'm afraid.
Well, there you go. There's another reason to go and visit Tallinn.
Go and find Lizzie. Yeah, absolutely right. But no, I've read great things about it. It's got many good economic indicators and all that kind of stuff. Like a lot of the East European places, once they came out from under the yoke of Russian or Soviet oppression, they flourished, and that might be one of them. But anyway, look, there's some terrible things happening in the world at the moment, Miss Jones. I mean, could you possibly have guessed that 33 years on, Salman Rushdie would finally, you know, receive the punishment that was put upon his head, the fatwa by the Iranian mullahs all those years ago? It came as a terrible shock to me, but remind us all what a dangerous place the world still can be.
I have to admit, I wasn't in the least bit surprised.
Really?
This was always coming.
Really?
You know, somebody who's had to have police protection all these years, he's been looking over his shoulder for most of his life.
Yes, he has, yeah.
Having written extremely provocative material, yes, we live in a free world, or we ought to, ought to be free by now. He ought to be able to write as a novelist whatever he chooses and to express his views. Surely that's what being human in the 21st century is all about. Well, he wrote them in the 20th century, didn't he? The most troublesome ones, which were the satanic verses.
Have you ever read it, by the way?
Well, this is the interesting thing. I think the vast majority of households own a copy of the satanic verses, a bit like Stephen Hawking's A Brief History of Time. So we've all got a copy of those books, but I don't think any of us has ventured further than a few pages.
Oh, I've never bought it, read it, had an inclination.
You haven't even got it. Have you got Midnight's Children? That's the other famous one.
No. Who wrote that?
Salman Rushdie.
No, I haven't. No, I've never read one of his books, honestly. I've never heard of him until the fatwa was issued. And then ever since then, he's just been a figure of fascination, marrying all these very young women about four times, I think, hasn't he? And
well, two funny things happened this week. I got an email from an editor at the Mail on Sunday asking to put them in touch, I should say, with a well-known, very prolific writer, because they wanted to ask him to write a piece about Salman Rushdie and the terrible attack.
Right.
So my first thought is, how the hell do they not have his number? Mm-hmm. Why are they coming to me to ask for his number? That's very lazy, isn't it?
It's very odd. I mean, everybody's got everybody's number these days, haven't they? You know,
exactly.
Yeah.
And it's not hard to find. But, I mean, what lazy gets, really? Second thought. So I obviously passed on the email and said, look, you know, you might want to get in touch. He emailed me straight back and he said, not only have I never met Salman Rushdie, but I've never read one of his books. What on earth would I have to say? And I think there is a sniffiness among authors towards Rushdie. You know, he has taken chances. He knew he was taking chances when he wrote the satanic verses. He knew he would incur the wrath of Iran and various other territories where he's offending Muslims and the religion of Islam. We should be able to say what we like. But how much of his expression was gratuitous?
Well, as I say, it's been going on for so long. I remember the day it was issued and I was the news editor of the Daily Express and I couldn't understand what it was all about. You know, it was, to me, it was so strange. This fatwa, this man called Salman Rushdie, what does it all mean? And then he spent the next 10 years with four armed police officers, as you quite rightly say, following around all over the place. I wonder if to this day he asked himself, was it worth it? It made him very famous and very wealthy, but if he'd had his time over again, surely he'd have said to his publishers, look, I've had a change of mind, let's pulp this one.
It's a bit sensationalist, isn't it, to publish something that you know is going to risk your life.
Well, yes.
Is fame and fortune... Has he made a fortune? Who knows? Because he hasn't been paying for the police protection.
No.
We've been paying for that.
No, that's true. Yeah.
But, you know, was it all worth it? He's a bit of a shagger by all accounts.
Yes, he is. He, as I say, he keeps marrying women about 40 years younger than him. Good for him.
Yeah, well, he's not the only one who does that, unfortunately. But yeah, men will never learn. The vast majority of men, I can't tar them all with the same brush, can I?
Not Miss Jones.
The vast majority of men will never learn. Handed on a plate, they are going to eat it.
Well, I think that's a bit of a generalisation, Miss Jones. Honest to God, sometimes...
Because, well, it is. It is a generalisation because it's generally true.
Yeah. Now, listen, you're a member of the Groucho Club, OK?
I am a proud member of the Groucho Club.
Yes, that's right. A very famous socialising centre in Soho in London, and all the great and the good in the literary world and the arts world, the media world goes there. That includes yourself, of course, Miss Jones. I think you're one of the founding members. So, needless to say, when I read in the business pages that the Groucho Club is exchanging hands for £40 million, I thought, we're in the money. And I thought you'd be inviting me over to the Soho, to the Groucho Club to buy me a slap-up lunch to celebrate your share of the profits for the sale.
Well, founder members are not shareholders.
What?
Of course not.
Good.
When did you ever join a club where you became a shareholder by dint of the fact that you were a founding member?
Well, I'm not a founder member of Everton Football Club, but I'm a shareholder, OK? And
it's different. Yeah, a football club membership is different.
Yeah, it is. I agree.
I have no stake whatsoever in the Groucho Club, other than that I pay my membership sum.
And how much is that?
Mine stays the same. I'm not going to reveal what it is, but mine remains the same as when I took out my membership in 1986.
So who's making the 40 million quid?
Well, it was owned by a consortium. It had been bought out. When the Groucho was founded, it was a collection of people sort of working in the arts who decided they wanted their own club where women were not excluded. That was a very big part of why it was founded.
Yeah.
And where like-minded people could come together in a private environment to, you know, hang out, be friends. What happens in the Groucho stays in the Groucho. Yeah. They've always had that ethos.
Yeah, sure.
And it's been quite a naughty place over the years, but not law-breaking by any stretch. So the original founders put the money in. I mean, not the founder members, but the founders of the club. Yeah. They kind of came together as a consortium. And that ran in that setup for many years. And then it was bought out by an investment company. And those people are the ones who've just sold it in this big deal.
There you go.
But I get from what I'm told, they've sold it to a couple who are planning to restore its authenticity and to make it less corporate and to return it to the kind of club that we all joined in the first place. I love the Groucho. Yeah. It's my front room. When I worked on Fleet Street in the late 80s, early 90s, that was my front room. I used to go there pretty much every day if I was in the country, if I was in London. And, you know, we'd have our supper there. We'd meet our friends.
Like a second office, was it?
Yeah, and a second front room.
Yeah, very good.
And, you know, you'd sometimes party on into the night if the right people came in and you were all having a good time. I remember falling asleep in armchairs in the corner, waking up there the next morning. Nobody would ever disturb you. Yeah. You could just stay where you were. So then you'd walk up to Topshop, buy a new shirt, walk down to Boots, buy a toothbrush, and walk on down to Fleet Street and go straight to work.
Well, that's the sort of behavior.
Did that more than a few times.
Yeah, good. That's the sort of behaviour I admire, Miss Jones. Talking about money and making money out of deals, Miss Jerry Hall's done all right, doesn't she? It's absolutely...
Well, we don't know any details. This is the tantalising thing.
Well, I think we do. I think the settlement of the divorce has been published. She gets a house in the south of France, apparently, Joanne Le Pen.
Well, she had that house already. That was hers.
Right, okay.
She's owned that house for years because my friend Bernie used to go down there with her husband.
Oh, blimey.
Every summer, Jerry would lend it to her. Oh, yeah. God. So she gets to keep her own house. Yeah. Big deal.
Yeah, but then didn't she get a... Now, the way I read it was, Rupert's kept a £16 million apartment in Manhattan. He's kept the vineyard in Beverly Hills, the only vineyard in the whole of Los Angeles, apparently, or certainly in Beverly Hills.
Well, that's his ranch. That's his ranch. Yeah, that he's had for a long
time. That's right. And also, this place in Montana, which I thought was bought for Jerry Hall, which is it's another ranch in cowboy country, Montana. It is so big, right, that it's 50 miles from one end to the other. I mean, can you imagine that?
Yeah, I don't think I'd fancy it really, but all of this is speculation. Murdoch has not published the absolute details of their divorce.
Yeah.
Because in some reports that I've read, she's down to get 100 million.
Yeah.
And in others, it says 200
million.
Yeah,
I've read all of that. I agree.
So this is all speculation and the details will never be published.
Yeah. What we do know is she got 30 million pounds off Mick Jagger. I mean, that seems like absolute, you know, chicken feed, doesn't it, compared to what she may...
Peanuts compared. Yeah. The thing is, Jerry's 65.
Yeah.
She's highly unlikely to get married again.
Well, you never know. You could have said that last time when she was 60.
You could have done. But, yeah, I don't think any of us would have put her together with Rupert Murdoch. Mm. I personally believe that marriage was a tax dodge.
Oh, come on, that's a bit harsh. Where's the age of romance gone? I read loads of reports to say they were incredibly affectionate towards each other all the time, you know, in the earlier days and all that. Anyway, I say, good old Rupe, you know, he started with nothing. He's a £15 billion fortune. It's entirely his decision how he runs his life, so...
Yeah, come on, Mike. Look what he did to Fleet Street. He dismantled our manor.
Well, he may have dismantled it physically, but he improved it endlessly by working practices. And you and I wouldn't have had jobs as long as we did in Fleet Street if the old system had been allowed to prosper. And the print unions ran the newspaper industry. He extended it by 30 years.
Newspaper industry is pretty much finished now. Yes. It hasn't got long to run.
I agree.
And this all started with Rupert Murdoch.
No. I think Rupert Murdoch saved it. I'm sorry, we're at completely different odds there. When the printers were running it, doing two-day weeks, but getting paid for seven-day weeks, and when they were pulling out their workers on strike all the time, papers weren't arriving in the morning, he got rid of all that. He took on the unions and he beat them. So I have to take my hat off to him. To move on, Miss Jones, when I was in Fleet Street, one of the great stories when I was news editor was a guy called Sir Ralph Halpern.
Oh, God, Randy Ralph.
Oh, yeah. Utterly incredible. You know, it all came into the open when a young 19-year-old sort of, I think she was called a glamour model in those days, right?
Fiona Wright.
Fiona Wright, you're absolutely right. Suddenly sold her soul to the News of the World. And guess who brokered the deal? Max Clifford.
Of course it was Max Clifford. What did we do without Max Clifford?
I have no idea. You know, the newspaper industry has gone into massive decline since poor old Max passed away in jail. But
we had no idea what a nasty bastard he was, did we?
We didn't in those days, although we found out later. But no, the sequence is that at 19 years of age, old Randy Ralph had picked her up at Stringfellow's because he, after his, you know, 12-hour day in the boardroom, at Debenhams, just for the benefit of our listeners, Ralph Halpern succeeded in buying Burton's, the men's retailer, and massively expanded it to take in Debenhams. I think, what's that really posh shop in the West End in London that Debenhams owned? It's one of the, you know, like, what's it called? Where you get the Christmas hampers and all that kind of stuff.
Fortnum &
Mason. Yes, I think it's that one. I think he ended up owning Fortnum & Mason's, all the Debenhams shops, Topshop he started and all that kind of...
Well, I was going to say, he founded
Topshop and Top Woman and all that kind of stuff, you know. So he was an amazingly successful... Top Man and Top Woman.
Was there Top Woman?
Yeah, honestly, yeah.
Oh, that's a horrible title.
Well, anyway, there you go. So he became, you know, the darling of the high street, making big profits and all that. But at the end of his 12-hour working day, he'd either go to Annabelle's or he'd go to Stringfellow's. And at Annabelle's, he would meet, you know, distinguished sort of titled ladies and all that kind of stuff. But at Stringfellow's, he would meet 19-year-old glamour models like Fiona Wright, you know. And then, of course, after a bit of a fling, somebody tipped her off. This could be worth a lot of money. She went to see Max. Next week, it was three pages in the News of the World. And, of course, Max introduced all sorts of lines, like five times a night, because his name was Sir Ralph Halpern. So they devised that headline and got a quote from her saying, oh, yes, he was at it at least five times. I mean, it was just the classic tabloid story.
I think the description would have been a voracious sexual appetite.
Yes, voracious sexual appetite. Anyway, Fiona got the boot, obviously, after the News of the World story. And then a couple of weeks later, we all went over to Stringfellow's, probably Stuart Higgins and me, you know what I mean, a few others.
Higgy the human sponge.
The human sponge, that's right. And we'd be sitting at Peter's table. He'd entertain us royally, you know, get some dinner and some champagne, lads, and all that kind of stuff.
He never let us pay. Peter Stringfellow was so generous, wasn't he?
I totally agree. And then all of a sudden, Ulfiona turned up and announced that she was Peter's new girlfriend. And somebody had to put her right and say, no, actually, Peter's got about 20 girlfriends, you know.
And he is also still married to Coral at the time.
That's absolutely right, yeah. But, oh, what a great story it was.
Those were the days. Do you remember the Shafters, the awards
yes,
that they used to hold at Stringfellow? Yes. So instead of the BAFTAs or the BAFTAs, it was the Shafters.
That's right.
And we all stitched each other up and came up with these spurious awards.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
I remember I was awarded something or other. Yeah. It was worst something or other, and Piers Morgan presented it.
Oh, right, okay, yeah, yeah. But honestly, those were the days. The other line that they needed a week two, you know, on this story. So Mac, they said to Max, you need another line. So Max came up with the line that Sir Ralph Halpern pinched Mrs. Thatcher's bottom at a political reception. And, you know, with a nod and a wink, insinuated that she rather liked it. You know what I mean?
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, yeah.
Who was that photographer that Thatcher had a thing with when she was still, was she education minister?
Yes.
And a photographer from The Express.
Yes, I know who it is.
Roger Taverner told me this story, went along to shoot her for a spread, as it were, and wound up in bed with her.
No,
who was this?
I'm not sure around her, but she wouldn't stop taking her clothes off, he told us. His name was Terry Disney. And
Terry Disney, that was it. Yeah, that was it.
His name was Terry Disney. He was a very languid sort of a guy. He never really smiled very much, you know, and he was sallow and quite sort of thin. Very good photographer, and he definitely had a way with the women. But his story is that Mrs. Thatcher was then living in Finchley, where she'd become MP, and she wanted to do a fashion shoot. You know, she was on the political path upwards. And Terry told me she just wouldn't stop taking her clothes off. You know, instead of doing the shoot downstairs, she said, oh, come to my bedroom, Mr. Disney. You know, that's where all my clothes are and all that. And I mean, Terry never told me there was intimacy between them, but he did say that she was a woman who clearly liked the attention of men. I didn't.
Well, he had his way with his telephoto lens, I can assure you.
Really? Wow.
He really, really, really.
This is a story given to you by Mr. Taverner, our former colleague.
So it has to be true.
Yeah, well, absolutely.
I read the best description of Randy Ralph in one of the papers, calling him talented, greedy, fearless Thatcherite.
Yeah, right, I suppose all those count. As often happens, it happened with Sir Philip Green, the empire eventually collapsed, okay?
Always does.
It always does.
Look what happened to the Romans.
Look what happened to the Romans, absolutely. Look what happened to the British Empire. And, you know, that was the typical story of somebody overreaching themselves. He started buying up the property in which the shops were contained, and then there was a property crash, you know, in the early 90s or something like that. But anyway, look, I love successful people, and if people didn't try and do it and get it right and create these great businesses, we wouldn't be the entrepreneurial country that we are. Right, OK, folks, you are listening to Life on Planet Porky with myself, the Portmeister, and the rock chick writer extraordinaire, Miss Leslie Ann Jones. We are both hoping that as we record with you now, there's a bit of humidity in the air, but it is getting a bit cooler. I hope that's the end of the heat wave and I won't have to dash off to Tallinn. Now, Miss Jones, of course, you are an expert in the world of pop music. So let's talk about a couple of pop music stories. Now, one I want to talk to you about is the sad death of Lamont Dozier. And he was the middleman, wasn't he, in Holland, Dozier, Holland. Tell us all about it.
Oh, yeah, sad, really. He was in his 80s, Lamont Dozier. One of those low-key music business people that, you know, people in the wider world wouldn't necessarily have heard of him.
Yeah.
But they would have heard his music, responsible for hits such as The Supremes, Where Did Our Love Go,
Where Did Our Love Go?
Stop in the Name of Love.
Nowhere. Yeah, all of those. Up the ladder to the roof where we can see heaven much better. I mean, he wrote all the classics.
That's not bad. Yeah. And of course, I can't help myself. You know, Sugar Pie, Honey Bunch, worked with Four Tops. So he was the kind of meat in the sandwich that was two brothers, Brian Holland and Eddie Holland. Yeah. Eddie Holland was responsible for most of the lyrics and the vocal production, and Brian Holland and Lamont Dozier worked on the arrangements, the musical arrangements, and the production side. Mm. But a lovely singer, songwriter himself.
Yes.
And record producer. He came from Detroit and co-wrote and co-produced 14 US Billboard number ones and 4 UK number ones. Just by all accounts, I never met him, but by all accounts, a lovely, sweet, low-key man who was a great loss to the music industry.
Well, he certainly is. He just died recently. Berry Gordy was the legendary head, wasn't he, of Tamla Motown? I think he had an affair with Diana Ross. I think they had a child together. I mean, he was a legend in the world of black music and basically invented it. And apparently, after Holland Dozier Holland had written about their sixth number one hit for Berry Gordy, they went and asked for a pay rise because the whole of the profits of Tamla Motown, the legendary label based in Detroit, Motor City.
Or Motortown, as it was known.
Motortown, as it was known. And Berry Gordy said, no, I'm not giving any more money. So they all left. And he had to.
Well, as you would, Interesting little factoid. Berry Gordy's daughter, Hazel Gordy, married Michael Jackson's brother, Jermaine. Really? I was going to say sister, though. I had to correct myself.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, Jermaine Jackson married Hazel Gordy.
Golly, I didn't know that. That's amazing.
Yeah, so when the Jackson...
Was her mother Diana Ross?
No.
Oh, it was another child, right.
No, whoever he was married to at the time. But so when the Jacksons left Motown, Jermaine Jackson couldn't leave because he was married to Berry Gordy's daughter.
Yeah, exactly.
So he had to stay on as a solo artist.
Yeah. But Michael Jackson had left a long time before that, hadn't he? Michael Jackson was signed up by Sony, wasn't he, or one of the bigger...
Michael Jackson went solo eventually, Epic was his label, part of CBS in those days.
Sure, amazing. Now then, tell me about the great battle between Blur and Oasis. It came to a head on this day in 1995 when they both decided to sort out who was the most popular Britpop band, because it was the era of the early days of New Labour and Tony Blair inviting pop stars to Downing Street and all that. So they both released a song on the same day and said, we'll fight it out at the top of the charts. I know that the Oasis song was, you gotta roll with it, you gotta see your time. But I can't remember what the Blur one was because I never really took to Blur.
No, neither did I. The interesting thing here is who cares? It's 27 years ago. Yeah. This was a manufactured feud. What they were trying to do, not the bands themselves, but the labels, the promoters, was to recreate a Beatles versus Stones situation.
Right.
But they never even came close. Mm-hmm. And these two bands, Oasis and Blur, they will never have the impact that the Beatles and Stones have had on popular culture.
Yeah.
And they will not go down in history in the same way. And they know that. Mm-hmm. So it was all just a little bit fake, to be honest. Didn't interest me at all. I didn't really care for Britpop.
I didn't really. And I didn't discover Oasis for about another 5 years or something. I'm always about 5 years behind ever since the Beatles split up. But I do really love Oasis now, but I've never really listened to a Blur record. Or Blur anything like Oasis at all?
No.
No. Softer, gentler, or what?
I think it's all in the name, Blur.
Oh, I see. Yeah, we're Blur.
As in it's all a bit of Blur.
I know what you mean. Right, okay, Miss Jones. Now, I read such a heart-lifting story this week that I need to talk to you about. I know you like football and sport and all that, and you are so proud of the achievements of your children. And to read that a boy of 17 has been signed by Reading Football Club, who is the deputy head boy of Eton College, just blew my socks off. I just couldn't believe it. We all have the image of football as being Wayne Rooney, who came from, you know, a pretty rough council estate, as they were called in those days, social housing area, in Liverpool, called Croxteth, and smashed his way to the top by the skill in his boots, you know, never took notice of any schoolwork after the age of about 14, playing football 12 hours a day, working man's game and all that. how astonishing that a boy who goes to probably the most privileged school in the world has managed to break through into the ranks of professional football. I think that's astonishing and very, very heartwarming.
I think everything you've just said there is a bit throwback, to be honest, and I don't mean to offend you by saying that.
You don't offend me, Miss Jones, believe me. You would offend me if you refused to buy me a drink occasionally, but you do not offend me by commenting on my analysis of social justice.
Get your priorities right, Michael. I think that this sort of business model of football as a working class game, that is so long gone.
I don't think it is.
It's not relevant anymore at all. For example, my son attended Dulwich College from the age of 3 until he was 18. Dulwich College is one of the finest schools in the world. The kind of school that would swap headmasters between Eton and DC, for example. Yeah. So a school of a similar standing. And football was taught assiduously there, and along with rugby, along with cricket. Mm. So those were the three main sports taught at Dulwich College. Yeah. And two of my son's best friends, Alex and Cam, were both signed with football clubs the minute they left school. I think it's a bit of a myth that it's a working class pursuit and that it's a way out of the slums. Yeah. I think that is long gone now.
Well, you say that, but I've never ever heard of an Eton schoolboy breaking through into the professional ranks before. Frank Lampard.
Well, Reading is the local club, by the way, to where Eton is.
Yeah, Windsor and Eton, you're absolutely right. It's just down the M4. But Frank Lampard, who's the manager of my club, Everton, his father, who was also called Frank Lampard Senior, Frank Lampard Junior, Frank Lampard Senior, will have been very well known to your father. He played in the West Ham team that won the FA Cup in 1964. He sent his son to a very good school. I can't remember which one it was, but Frank got a grade A in A-level Latin, you know, and he never, ever talked about it in the dressing room because, of course, he would have been seen as a bit of a freak. So it's always mystified me why footballers who've been rich now for the last 20 years since the Premier League started have not sent more of their children to the top schools. For instance, Wayne Rooney has got 4 boys. Wouldn't he be wise to go and put their names down for Eton now so that they get the best possible start in life?
She wouldn't send them to boarding school. Colleen would not part with her children. Her children are what define her.
Well, no, you can go to Eton as a day pupil, but I agree.
You can if you live there.
Yeah, you're right. They live in Cheshire, so you might be right.
She's not going to do that. Her kids are her... I don't mean this unkindly. Yeah. Colleen's children are her accessories. They are the thing that validate her.
Well, she's also an adoring mother, isn't she, of 4 boys. You know?
Yeah, we are all adoring mothers, by the way. Yeah. Let's not put down mothers here. Yeah. There are no degrees of being a mother. You either are one or you're not. I think they would be intimidated by those kinds of schools.
Well, I don't think they would, because they've been brought up in such wealth and privilege now anyway. They're equal
It's not about wealth. It is not about wealth. It's about intellect. And there's a massive difference between wealth and intellect.
Well, I agree. But if you grow up in a home that's worth £20 million and you've got access to every single, you know, item of information being delivered, you know, books and anything you want on the internet and all that, I think you become naturally intelligent yourself by becoming interested.
I think you're missing my point, which is that you can't buy brains.
No, you can't buy brains.
You cannot buy brains, and it's all to do with DNA.
Absolutely. Because I went to a direct grant grammar school, the King's School Chester, which was classified as a public school because our headmaster used to attend something called the Headmaster's Conference. We used to play in the public school's cup competition. We played Eton. We also played Repton, which is another great school from Derbyshire, Harrow, and Shrewsbury Grammar, which is another brilliant school. And they all had facilities which we couldn't even match at the King's School Chester. That's the amazing thing. I mean, they said that, you know, the British Empire was built on the playing fields of Eton. Well, it could be that the future England team might have been built on the football pitches of Eton. We'll have to see. Now, I am very upset to read, Miss Jones. I know you're not a great viewer of TV and all that kind of stuff, but Idris Elba apparently has ruled himself out of becoming the next James Bond. I thought he would have been absolutely perfect.
He might have been, but I didn't think he was ever really in the frame.
Really?
No, it's a very limiting role if you think about it, and it's also anachronistic. They've tried to make the character and the stories move with the times, But it's essentially a throwback. It's a dinosaur kind of setup, isn't it, really? And I think he sees himself as a much more 21st century man than that.
Yeah, no, I think you could be right. I saw a Pierce Brosnan one the other night, No Time to Die, I think it was, because I still love the Bond. Do you know what I love the Bond movies? I love the opener. The opener is always absolutely spectacular. You know, the three white sort of windows come up and then Bond strides forward, turns and fires his gun. And then the plot starts. And that's something spectacular. And then when that's resolved itself, then the titles come up and all that. So I always watch it really for about the first 10 minutes and then kind of get bored, as you quite rightly say. But the Pierce Brosnan one was terrible. They were trying to, you know, it came after Roger Moore. And I don't know what they were trying to do, but it was just far too obviously sexist. You know what I mean? You know, he slept with every woman and he came across and some of the women, you know, inside MI6, you know, couldn't keep their hands off James and all that kind of stuff. And it actually bored me and made me feel quite, I don't know, even Sean Connery and Roger Moore never sank to those sort of levels. That's what I'm saying. It was terrible.
The other thing, of course, is that we have a tremendous problem with gun crime in the world. Yeah. And there is so much shooting in those films. What was the Daniel Craig one where he's in his, what's that car he drives?
Aston Martin.
The one with all the guns that come out of
Aston
it.
Aston Martin. And,
yeah, so there was this just kind of fest of firing and violence and hideousness.
The opening was him in his Aston Martin and another two cars or three cars all trying to blow him away with about 25 machine guns, and he stayed alive by just ducking the bullets occasionally. I mean, yeah, I know the one.
And why are we celebrating guns?
Well,
I think that's what it boils down to. James Bond is they are tremendously violent films. The modern versions
they are, them. But we all know it's all made up. I mean, it's not.
Yeah, but you get people who don't know the difference.
Yeah.
You get people who do not observe that thin line that divides that from that, which is entertainment real life.
Well, maybe you are right.
I think Idris Elba is more evolved than that.
Yeah, maybe it's a dying franchise. Who knows? Who knows?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think
when the Bourne movies came out, it completely shook the James Bond lot because they thought we're not as good. Because it was clinically ruthless in a way that Bond wasn't. So they got rid of all the laugh lines in Bond then. And I'm afraid they've been drifting around ever since, trying to find an identity, in my view. I tell you who's 65 today, Madonna.
Madonna.
We don't hear much of her these days, do we? She's been completely eclipsed by so many younger pop stars and people like Adele and... who's he on? Beyonce and people like that. I barely ever see a line on Madonna these days.
It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, I think she went on too long in the first place. I think she should have just kind of ducked out graciously. She was trying to push that image of being a sex goddess for way too long, to the point that she became ridiculous. And there was that... the Music Awards, the Brit Awards, when she was performing with the cape, do you remember? And she took a tumble down the stairs. I think she tripped on the cape or something or other.
Yeah.
And ended up in a heap on the stage and was humiliated by it. And I thought to myself at that stage, maybe it's just time to hang up the cape, you know, and the microphone while you're at it. Because to me, she hasn't made an astonishing record for... 2 or 3 decades.
Yeah, I agree. Now. About 30 years, I would agree. When I used to live and work in America, you know, once you heard a Madonna tune come on the car radio, or if you're in the back of a yellow cab or something like that, it was a sign of the times. And I totally agree. I don't think these days she's got a role in it. Have you seen a story about this morning, Miss Jones, as we're recording, about David Gilmour, the legendary Pink Floyd musician, who built a house on the front at Hove, which is next to Brighton, because posh people, when asked, oh, do you live in Brighton? They say Hove, actually, because it's supposed to be a better suburb.
Like people who live in Hull, and they'll say Ashby, actually.
Ashby de la Zouche. And he bought this plot on the front at Hove and then spent 2 or 3 years battling the locals who objected to him knocking it down and had plans to rebuild it as a house. It was originally a bathhouse, an old-fashioned bathhouse. So it's a huge place, right? And eventually got it done, and it's now built in the style of the architecture around it. And yet, after living there for 2 years, he's now put it on the market and wants to sell it for 15 million quid. I mean, I don't get some of these things, these people who've got more money than maybe logic get up to.
I could not be bothered, to be honest with you. If you're going to buy a place and then knock it down and build something else, that's either because you it's a project and you're obsessed with that kind of thing, or you've got nothing better to do.
Yeah.
I'd rather buy a place that was finished if I had that kind of money in a location that I really loved and just lived in it. But he's an odd one, Gilmore. And so is his wife, Polly Sampson.
Yeah, well, their son went to jail for swinging around on the flags at the Cenotaph.
Yeah, I always get him mixed up with Brian Ferry's son.
No, Otis, it's not him.
He did a similar thing, didn't he?
Yeah.
Not that I really care. Mm. I mean, look, the guys took the punishment on the chin and that's all well and good, but Gilmore I've never really warmed to him, I have to say.
Was he the goodie or the baddie in the split with Pink Floyd? Because was Gilmore the sort of the songwriter and the other guy the sort of technically brilliant guitarist?
Roger Waters.
Roger Waters, yeah. Who was the goodie and who was the baddie?
It's hard to say.
Right.
I think it swings and roundabouts, six of one, half a dozen of the other, all of that. Mm. Yeah. They went to my college, actually, or should I say I went to theirs.
Oh.
University of Westminster, which is just on the top end of Regent Street, across from the BBC.
Oh, right, okay.
We all went there, but they've got a blue plaque on the wall outside, and nobody's honoured me in that way.
Well, that's a disgrace, Miss Jones.
I think so too. I think we should do something about it.
Have you been watching Martin Lewis spouting off over the last few days?
He's lost the plot, hasn't he?
I think he thinks he runs the country. I mean, I saw him the other morning, and he was crying, you know, it's cataclysmic. What's happening is, yeah, we all know that, Martin, but I'm afraid we've all got to try and, you know, bite our lip.
Get a grip, Mark.
Yeah, no, I agree.
He's become a bit hysterical, and I think he's lost credibility because of
that. Yeah, I do.
I really did like reading his blog, but then when he sold it, it's still called Martin Lewis's Money Tips, I think.
That's right.
But he sold out, didn't he? And I think when anybody...
He sold out. He sold the business for 85 million quid, so good luck to him, you know.
Yes, in a way. Mm-hmm. But that sort of smacks of take the money and run, and I don't really care.
Oh, come on, he built up a fantastic business. He got the idea first. The fact that he had money in the email address made it a winner, and it attracted hundreds of millions of viewers and subscribers and all that. So a very, very bright boy who, as I think I've told you before, attended my school, the King's School Chester, and his picture is on the wall in the Hall of Fame next to mine.
Oh, your picture's there as well?
Of course.
Oh, I need to go and see this. Yeah. We need to go to Chester and have a little jaunt. Yeah. And I need to go and pay homage to your picture on the wall.
Absolutely.
I'm not taking the piss. I really want to do that.
Yeah, well, that's very good of you, Miss Jones. Thank you. But you're absolutely right. When he used to come and appear on my radio show, he was a very humble guy who, you know, talked very fast. I used to say, golly, Martin, I said, you get 200 words a minute out of your mouth. I said, that even beats me. And he used to laugh about it and all that kind of stuff, you know. But he was a very humble guy, and he was... What he was doing in those days was he was giving us information and opinions, whereas these days it seems to me he's lecturing us and telling us how the world must be run, you know?
Mm. Yeah, he's not the Chancellor, and he would do well to back down and remember that, I think.
I totally agree.
But, yeah, I mean, maybe he should have run for Prime Minister, you know? And I've gotten absolutely no faith whatsoever in the two who are left in the race.
Well, I'm afraid that's all there is left now, so we're going to have to see what happens over the next 18 months or 2 years. Right, okay, folks, that's it for another week on Planet Porky. Thank you very much indeed for having joined. Just thank you, Miss Jones, again for your company for the last 45 minutes or so, an hour or so. And we will be back with you all this time next week. My initial interest in Estonia was prompted by the fact that at one of my local pubs, before lockdown and COVID and all that, there was the most beautiful barmaid. I mean, utterly...
Oh, here we go.
She was utterly beautiful, honestly. And
it always boils down to sex.
Well, I'm not sure it does, but her name was Lizzie. and she had dark black hair. She had the most magnificent figure. I mean, I'm not joking. You know, she was beautiful.
Not that you checked her out or anything.
Well, you couldn't help but check her out because the way she dressed was, I mean, talk about the definition of the buxom wench, you know, serving behind the bar for...
Oh, you are so predictable.
For want of using an old-fashioned expression, which, of course, I wouldn't use these days. But, I mean, it was, you know, men used to go to that pub just to be able to stand on the other side of the bar and ogle Lizzie because she was so beautiful. And
to ogle Lizzie's assets.
Yes, that's right.
Oh, dear, dear.
Of course, I wasn't amongst that number. I'm mature enough and able enough to look a woman in the eye, you know what I mean, without...
without noticing what's going on below.
That's right, without becoming distracted. Posh people, when asked, oh, do you live in Brighton? They say Hove, actually, because it's supposed to be a better suburb.
Like people who live in Hull, and they'll say Ashby, actually.
Ashby de la Zouche.
I think the vast majority of households own a copy of the Satanic Verses, a bit like Stephen Hawking's A Brief History of Time. Yeah. So we've all got a copy of those books. But I don't think any of us has ventured further than a few pages.
Oh, I've never bought it, read it, had an inclination.
You haven't even got it. Have you got Midnight's Children? That's the other famous one.
No. Who wrote that?